can't solve a problem at the same level it was created.
I worked very hard for 10 years to become an overnight sensation.
Your growth has to be number one. That is the first rule.
You need to be able to imagine something being better.
And I think the fear is missing a life and not experiencing your full capacity.
The only way to learn to see is to make assertions, see what happens, learn from it, and then do it again.
You're listening to the Humans 2.0 podcast. This is your host, Mark Metry.
You're listening to episode 295 with Akshay Nanavati. Akshay is a Marine veteran, speaker, adventurer, and entrepreneur. His new book, Fearvana, is an actionable guide on how to leverage fear to accomplish anything looking at the science. The Dalai Lama himself has said that Fearvana inspires us to look beyond our own agonizing experiences and find the positive side of our lives. While you're listening to this podcast, if anything sticks out to you as thought-provoking or interesting, take a screenshot, write down what you heard, and feel free to share it on social media, text it to a friend. And without further ado, episode 295 with Akshay. So Akshay, the first question that I always start off and ask my guests is, how do you spend your time here on planet Earth?
Love that. I spend my time cultivating legend in myself and others. That's my whole mission, is cultivating greatness, helping people tap into their own personal legend and live at that at the highest level within myself and for others.
That's awesome, man. I usually tend to think of myself as a living legend too, but
yeah.
You know, honestly, man, I wanted to have you on this podcast because a wide variety of people told me to check out your work and to get you on because, you know, they know what I talk about and they know what you talk about. I think the first time I heard of you was just listening to Aubrey Marcus's podcast, and you know, you kind of talked about, and I kind of heard your story for the first time on how you went on basically like this crazy journey from like, you know, contemplating suicide to having a really interesting dynamic with being a U.S. soldier to kind of like stepping back and looking at the science and kind of like going on your own journey of just trying to heal. And then now you're sort of doing it for others, man. So, you know, I don't want to cut around, but I would love to just sort of begin this and say, you know, for you, was there a particular turning point in your life? You know, were there a series of problems, of issues that you were experiencing? And just, you know, tell us a little bit about that time, how old you were, what you're doing, what your thoughts were like, what your mentality was like to
sure.
That's cool.
Yeah. You know, I've had a few different, like I would say, major turning points in my life. One was when I was in high school. I had moved around a lot. By the time I moved to Austin, Texas, I was 13 years old, lived in four different cities at this point. Soon after moving to the US from India and Singapore, I got very heavily into drugs, into alcohol, very self-destructive. I still have scars on my arm from when I used to cut myself, burn myself.
Wow.
Scars are a constant reminder today of where I was and the place I had been in. And the turning point in my life, I mean, and I could have easily died. I lost two friends to drug addiction, and it would have easily been me. Like, I was me and this one other guy who is no longer alive. We were the first in our group to start going into harder drugs. Wow. And thankfully, my turning point was, the trigger for that turning point was watching the movie Black Hawk Down. Have you ever seen that movie?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, very powerful movie, war movie based on a true story. And watching that movie, watching the courage of men who knowingly sacrifice their lives for somebody else. And in the movie, there's this scene where Gary Gordon, Randy Shugart, they sacrifice their lives for somebody else. They receive the Medal of Honor, which is the highest award for courage and valor in the United States military. Just watching that, it triggered something in me. And right after watching that movie, I read the book Black Hawk Down, started reading book after book on military and life in combat, and almost overnight stopped doing drugs and decided to join the Marines.
Whoa.
That was kind of the turn. That was turning point number one for sure, is that movie was planted the seed that transformed my life.
And so, man, I'm curious. I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but do you, like, kind of looking back at it now, do you know why you sort of began to turn to hardcore drug abuse and alcohol?
Yeah, you know, we've pondered it a lot, even with my parents, because I'm very close to my parents today. I have great parents, no sort of abuse or anything like that. They've asked, you know, what could we have done differently to prevent you going down that path? Part of it now, looking back, is I had, again, moved to four cities by the time I was 13, right? So when I moved to the U.S., by no means sure of who I wanted to be. I did not have the maturity you do. You know, I've read about your story too. I did not know who I wanted to be. I did not have my path clear. So as a result, when I came to the US, I was just trying to fit in to my world around me. And, you know, I take responsibility for my own actions. I don't blame anybody. But when you're a 14, 15 year old kid, you're very at the effect of your environment. Mm. And I got into a group of friends that we started doing, you know, drinking and doing drugs. And I always say, looking back, like, had I gotten to a group of friends who were ultra runners or mountaineers, I would have pushed that line to the hardest, you know. Like, I'm always been that kind of person who's going to anything I take up, I will go to the extreme. So when I got into drugs, I was the one pushing the line, you know, doing the hardest drugs, cutting myself, taking all of that whole lifestyle to its most extreme. And I was at a point, man, I would have done any drug that came my way. Thankfully, more did not come my way. There was many, many, many scenarios that, looking back, I could not have, like, I could have died and we wouldn't be having this conversation today. Mm-hmm. So it was just really, yeah, being lost and not having clarity. And that movie gave me some clarity, gave me clarity of purpose, clarity of mission. And, you know, even then joining the Marines was a challenge. I mean, I have a blood disorder that two doctors told me would kill me in Marine Corps boot camp. Mm. I have flat feet. I have scoliosis. So I had all these disqualifying conditions. But now, after knowing who I wanted to be, it didn't matter what anybody said. That was going to be my path and I was going to make it happen no matter what. Mm. And so it took me about a year and a half, but finally I did get in the Marines.
Mm. Yeah, and I find it really crazy the power of, you know, really well done multimedia, cinema, or maybe even music, in the effect that it can have, that someone can look at it sort of the right place, right time in their life, that can almost just give their mind the ability to understand a little bit of potential, to understand a little bit of future, to maybe see, like, you know, there is maybe a light at the end of the tunnel. And so, you know, for me, I had that with like a Steve Jobs video. You know, I've heard that with a lot of other people. David Goggins with like watching the Rocky movies, different things like that. And, you know, I'm curious to ask you, what was sort of the experience like of deciding to join the military and putting yourself through that process in terms of like your mentality?
You know, it was – so when I first joined, I wasn't a U.S. citizen. I was a green card holder. I was an Indian citizen. So there was a lot of struggles now, I mean, with my parents, right? Here's this – this was post-9/11 world, so almost certainly I would end up going to war, which, of course, I did later on. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge with my parents is now, here's this kid. At this point, I had been arrested. I had been caught doing drugs in school, caught stealing. Wow. I mean, I got caught doing everything. I wasn't very good at doing things and getting away with it either. So I got caught doing everything in school. So on the one side, my parents are seeing this kid heading down a very destructive path. On the other side, now he wants to join a military for a country that's not his, really. And inevitably would go to war. So I've been a nightmare of a child to them, and no doubt I empathize with the struggles I put them through. So it was a challenge for them to deal with, because they didn't know, you know, which path. Like, it was a hard for them. So that was one side. For me, initially I was going to join the Army and I wanted to go Special Forces, because that, like, Black Hawk Down was Army Rangers and Delta Force. So that's what, you know, my path was. That's what inspired me. But when I first joined, I couldn't go Special Forces because I wasn't a U.S. citizen. In order to go into Special Forces to become an officer, you have to have secret clearance. In order to get that, you have to be a U.S. citizen. So I just said, I'm going to join the Marines, which are the toughest branch, right, in the U.S. military, not including Special Forces. So I wasn't very physically fit either. Like, even when I went to boot camp, I was not very physical. I mean, I had just come out of doing a very heavy, like, drug lifestyle. So I was not very fit, but I was mentally just ready. Like, even in boot camp, you know, no matter how physically tough it was, I mentally thrived. I graduated infantry school as the honor graduate of my platoon, right? So I was ready to embark upon this path, and nothing at this point would come in my way. I also think that had it not been a post 9/11 world, I would not have been able to join because I had so many of these disqualifying medical conditions. But, you know, post 9/11, here's a young dumb kid wanting to go infantry as well in the front lines. Yeah, we'll find a way for you to come, you know. So so I mean, it sort of, I would say, worked out. But it was so clear to me that was my path, that it didn't matter what anybody said ultimately. And I, you know, I tried to do the best I could to help guide my parents through it for the challenges they were facing emotionally. Because it's much, I mean, even going to war, it's much tougher on the family back home than it is for us out there. So it's been hard for them. Today, hopefully they're, today I know they're proud of me, but it's been a rough road.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I bet they're proud of you now that you have, you know, the Dalai Lama endorsing your book and all that stuff. So
I'm very blessed now.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, dude, tell me about the time where, you know, you kind of went to the military and you ended up coming back and kind of like this real mental turmoil that I heard you describe on Aubrey's podcast as and how that sort of began to just take shifts on your mental state.
Yeah, roger that. So when I joined the Marines, I was volunteering to go to war every chance I could. I don't mean to sound like sort of a war junkie or anything like that, but after watching the movie Black Hawk Down, reading about combat, watching other war movies, the fascination, if you will, with the experience of war was that war is this experience where you get to taste humanity at its most extremes. In war, you see people doing the most horrific things, humanity at its worst, but you also see humanity at its best, sacrificing their lives for somebody else, jumping on a grenade for somebody else, like Gary Gordon and Randy Sugart, you know, volunteering to go down to face thousands of armed enemy just as two people and to die for somebody else. So I wanted to experience humanity at that level, at the experience the human condition at its most extreme. So I was volunteering to go every chance I could. And I got really close actually to this friend of mine when we first joined the unit, and we were volunteering every chance we could. Twice the Marines told us we would go. Last minute, they would cancel it. And one summer, while I was vacationing in India with my family, this friend of mine, Corporal Neil, he ended up finding a unit to go with. And he was a good Marine, so he was promoted to corporal. And as a result, he was in a seat that got hit with an IED, an improvised explosive device, and he was killed. Jeez. And that always, to this day, it stayed with me, because even when we joined the unit together, you know, we were the same kind of Marine. As I said, we came like brothers, we volunteered to go together, but I would beat him by a few seconds on the run or a few points. I mean, literally just a few seconds or maybe a couple of points on the rifle range. And so when he went and he got promoted, I felt like I should not have been vacationing. I should have gone with him. And I should have gotten that promotion, so I should have been in his seat so he could have come back home to his fiance and to his family. And 2 months after he died, I finally got called up to go to Iraq. And so at this point, I was ready to go, right? I mean, I'd been waiting to go. And I went out there, admittedly a very naive perspective. I understand that in war, you can't control. Like, I could have still gone with him and he could have still died. I could have still come back home, right? You can't control what happens in war. But I went out there with this sort of mentality that if somebody has to die out there, let it be me. And in many ways, not expecting to come back alive. Now, went out there, you know, war was what it was. You go through the challenges, the ups and downs of it. I had a pretty interesting experience too. One of my jobs out there was to walk in front of our vehicles looking for bombs before they could be used to kill me and my fellow Marines. So yeah, somewhat dangerous job, right? Because who would get blown up first if the IED hit? But you know, I struggled with my time in the war, as one does, and mostly because it wasn't as hostile as I wanted. I did not get shot. You know, we had rounds go off, we had rockets go off, we had an IED hit a vehicle in our company. I wasn't in that vehicle, but it hit another vehicle in our company, and thankfully nobody was killed. But I when I came back, I struggled with the fact that I did not get shot. I didn't lose a limb. People had died out there. People had suffered so much more than me. I didn't suffer enough to earn my place on this planet. So when I came back, I was volunteering to go back every chance I could. I said, send me back to Iraq. Send me back to Afghanistan. I didn't have a plan for what to do with this life here, you know, this life in the normal world. I did not get my chance to volunteer to go back. So after graduating undergrad, I decided to go to journalism school because I wanted to go back to war as a war journalist. I was craving to go back to combat.
Yeah, and so, you know, just so I can kind of like understand this, so you go off to, when you come back after your first round, you come back, you go on vacation to India, you have this buddy that, you know, you guys kind of train together, you guys do everything together, he goes off, gets promoted, passes away, gets killed, and now you kind of feel like this survivor's guilt. And so when you go back to war, are you, like, is your mentality like, you know, is it sort of, you know, I'm going to be brave and I'm going to do this for my friend and just out of courage? Or was it like, life sucks. I don't even know what to do anymore. I'm going to try to go on like the route of like somehow assisted suicide.
Hmm. Great question. It wasn't the latter. It wasn't sort of this life sucks. Let me, let me go out there and die. It was the former. And by no means, but I want to be very clear, by no means did I do anything heroic. I'm not a hero, not even close. And it was a very naive perspective because, again, you can't control that in war. I mean, I could go out there, you could be on a mission and bullets fly where they fly or bombs hit where they hit, right? You can't control that. But I went out there with this mentality that I would rather die than somebody else. And I still remember while training for the war, this guy, buddy of mine, was cutting my hair, and he was just sharing about his family, this buddy of mine, Cortez. And I still remember sitting there listening to him talk about his family. He's be like, man, I want him to come back home to his family, you know? So it was that kind of mentality that let me be the one. So when I got that job sort of walking in front of vehicles, I was like, yeah, done. Let's do it. You know, I didn't have any problems with doing whatever I had to do out there. I mean, I even gave away a lot of my stuff before I left, like a lot of my outdoor gear and stuff like that before I left for the war. So it made it awkward when I came back. I'm like, hey, guess what? I'm back. I need all my stuff back, y'all. But it definitely was the former in terms of how I went out there.
I see.
Yeah.
And you know, honestly, man, I'm curious to ask you more before we get more down your story of like survivor's guilt. Because, you know, I've talked to some people personally, I've never experienced it, but I've talked to some people who have, and they haven't been to war. So, I mean, I'm curious now that you look back at it, like, and I'm sure you've talked to other people about it. I mean, what is that? How does somebody like think about that? Is there a way to kind of cope with that?
Yeah, you know, people kind of deem, and in my own healing since this, obviously now I'm in a good space, but since my own healing, which we'll come back to here in a second, but just in the context of staying on survivor's guilt, since my own healing, you know, people demonize guilt as something bad. Guilt is not framed as a positive emotion. Everybody told me after this, you know, don't feel guilty. Again, rationally, I got it. Rationally, I got that I could have gone to war with him and he could have still died. I could come back. But there's a difference between how the rational brain works and the emotional brain works. The emotional brain wasn't ready to let go of that guilt. And to this day, it's still somewhat present. I've navigated a lot, and we'll talk about that as well. But guilt is an expression of love. That reframe allowed me to understand and really embrace the guilt as not something to... Everybody said, don't feel guilty. And it wasn't going away. You know, saying don't feel what you feel. And we do this all the time with all kinds of emotions. Don't feel guilty. Don't worry. Don't be scared. Don't stress out. We're just saying don't feel what you feel. That's a problem. Feel what you feel because it's there for a reason. Understand it. The reason I felt survivor's guilt, and again, like you said, it's not just veterans. Anybody who, a lot of people who lose somebody will say something like, why did they die and not me? Right? We question that. And that's an understandable thing because that guilt is an expression of love. And I allowed myself to reframe my guilt and it didn't go away. And for a long time, and only recently, literally a few months ago, did I change this. And I'll explain why I changed this. But for a long time, I had a picture of my friend that I lost up in the war up on my wall. And it said, this should have been you. Earn this life. That's an intense thing to see every day, right? It's an intense thing to say, this should have been you. Earn this life. But my guilt worked for me for a long time. Till it did not. I mean, only recently I changed it to honor his death. Earn this life. Subtle shift, but a big shift. And I did that because the guilt was just going too far, and we can kind of get to that in my continued healing. But yeah, to the point, anybody else out there who's suffering with survivor's guilt, just acknowledge that it's a place of love, and it doesn't have to be something dark. It can be intense, but there are no bad or good emotions. And a great line to kind of summarize this, especially when we lose people we love, I read this in my own healing from this fantastic book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People by Harold Kushner. And he has this one line where he says, the dead depend on us for their redemption and their immortality.
Wow.
Such a powerful line that helped me, at least, and helped others I've shared it with, say that, look, these people, you can't change the fact when somebody's died. You can't bring them back, obviously, but you can immortalize them through your actions. So when I look at now to honor my friend's death, to honor a lot of people I've lost, is that the work I do is in service of something greater. And I don't have the right to waste my life drinking it liters of vodka like I did once. Now it's a responsibility that's bigger than me, right? So the dead depend on us for their immortality.
Dude, that's so beautiful, man. That's honestly probably the best thing I've heard over the last few days. And I, you know, I love what you said about guilt. And, you know, I also kind of had a similar perspective on it until I kind of realized what you said of guilt is an emotion of love. And I realized that, you know, a lot of the times when maybe I did do something that I, you know, wasn't supposed to, or I didn't do something that I was supposed to, I would feel this sense of guilt, and I would, you know, in turn get shameful about it and kind of go down the spiral. But then I kind of stood back and I kind of came with the perspective that you have of like, maybe the reason why I'm feeling guilty about not doing these things or doing the wrong things is because I know, like, deep down I'm a good person and I have a moral compass leading to me.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a good thing that, you know, it's almost giving me like neurofeedback to course correct me in my path in life. And I think it becomes an issue when like that guilt, you know, you maybe overly obsess about it and it turns into shame and it begins to like seep into your character and you now feel like you're a moral failure. So, I mean, that's a whole other kind of segment, but to, you know, to sort of get back to your healing, man, what did you do to sort of get out of that kind of like really, you know, bad mind, that
dark
mindset
space
that you were in? Yeah.
So, you know, after I came back a few years later, I had, like, I went to master's school, my master's degree, then had a corporate job for a year and a half. And then when I left that corporate job and left school, like, you're no longer in college. And I actually, when I left the corporate job, I spent a month racking 190-pound sled for 350 miles across the world's second largest ice cap in like minus 40 degrees. Intense expedition, beautiful expedition, but really, like, now looking back, what I was doing was running away from my demons. I was looking to go back to a hostile environment, like war. In many ways, going into these polar expeditions, mountaineering, it replicates some of the simplicity of war. So I was running away every chance I could. And now without that, those expeditions, without a job, without college, that's when my demons started to rise up. So, you know, from like, I was at a point where I would maybe drink one day a week, then 2 days a week. And I was not, at least for a little while, not drinking every day. But when I drank pretty hard. And then slowly that was getting worse and worse and worse. And I got to a point in my life where I would drink an entire bottle of vodka a day. I would drink till I pass out, wake up, drink again. And this would go on for 5 to 7 days until my body just couldn't take it. Until, I mean, I've been in a place where I would be throwing up. After I throw up, I pick up a bottle and drink again just because I cannot. I mean, it was, yeah, it was horrific. Again, sometimes I'm just blessed that I made it through it. But what happened was one morning after one of these binge sessions, I was at a point where I thought this pattern of drinking and sobering up would never change. So I was about to walk over to the kitchen, pick up a knife, and slit my own wrists.
Wow.
And that was the trigger. Like, the fact that I had gotten to such a low moment where I actually thought about taking my own life, that hit me hard. How could I even think that? How could I even get there? And it didn't magically change overnight from there, but that was the trigger that led to my sort of climb out of the darkness, climb out of the abyss. I started then researching neuroscience, psychology, spirituality to understand my own pain, to understand my own suffering, to understand the human brain. And ultimately that led me to Fearvana and everything I do, because I realized that how we view suffering is deeply flawed. How we view pain is deeply flawed. And so I had to then sort of share everything I learned. Because even before this, like before I hit that low moment, I was seeing a therapist. I was seeing a therapist at the VA. And they were good people, by the way, great people. They really cared. They wanted to help. But as I came to learn in my own research much later on, is that they were just operating from a really bad playbook. And the model for how we view mental health and therapy is very flawed. So that's why when I kind of got on my own path of researching, of healing, of learning, did I shift that, at least in my own take, shift my own model and how I healed myself, and then started to share it through my work with Fearvana. But that moment was the trigger that kind of changed everything.
Wow, man. So, you know, this is such an interesting topic because, you know, in my own version, I've kind of gone down this route of kind of like flipping the way that I view fear and kind of like going on the offense, I guess. Mm-hmm, so, I mean, I'm curious for you, like, was there something that you learned? Was there like a first step? Was there something that you kind of did that sort of gave you the insight to,
absolutely.
You know, I'm not sure if you built a plan or how you kind of went about this, but, you know, now you and I can sort of like look back at this and kind of at least sort of understand kind of like the primal emotions and thoughts and feelings that can create fear, and we sort of know how to like move on that path. But for someone who's been in that, for maybe they experienced you know, maybe some kind of anxiety their entire lives, and they've just been so ingrained in that every single day, it can almost seem like a prison that you can't break out.
Absolutely.
And so I'm curious, like, how do you begin to teach people how to flip fear itself?
Yeah. So great question. So, you know, when I started healing, when I started reading this stuff myself, I started to learn that there's a distinction. So in the context of post-traumatic stress disorder, and this applies to fear and every emotion, but I had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. They told me because I have survivor's guilt, because I struggled with loud noises. Every time a loud noise, I was hypervigilant, right? I did not like crowds. So these were symptoms that they said equated to post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. As I started to research and learn, I realized that these are very normal human responses to war. In war, your brain says loud noise equals death. So inevitably, you stay hyper alert. Mm. Your subconscious brain, we don't control most of what happens in our brain. Our subconscious simply reacts to external stimuli because our brain is still designed for an archaic world where there were life-threatening, you know, life-threatening things and stressors all the time, like tigers and the wilderness, right? So it responds and reacts. It cares only about our survival. Like right now, if you and me are sitting in a room, and if somebody came into this room with a gun, we would feel fear. Our brain would respond with fear, not because we're choosing it. It reacts to the world. So all these things I was feeling were not things I was choosing. They were just normal human responses to war. And yet the problem that I came to learn was attaching the word disorder was the fundamental problem. Post-traumatic stress is not indicative of post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. Post-traumatic growth is just as real as post-traumatic stress. Disorder. And we can create a new paradigm based on how we view it. Like, there's a great example of this. So Dr. Martin Seligman, he went to West Point, the military academy, and he asked the cadets, how many of you have heard of post-traumatic stress disorder? And it was like 90-95% of people raised their hands. Mm-hmm. He then asked them, how many of you have heard of post-traumatic growth? And it was less than 5%. So we've created a self-fulfilling prophecy that trauma equals disorder, that stress is bad, fear is bad, and this translates to fear or anxiety. So fundamentally, when somebody's navigating this, you mentioned the example, let's say somebody's dealing with anxiety their whole life. Mm. At this point, and I've worked with somebody who had this, he would feel severe anxiety every time he sat on his computer to write. He went to every therapist and everybody was trying to get rid of the anxiety for him. He came to me and I said, our goal right now is not to get rid of the anxiety because you don't control the anxiety right now. Your brain has created a pattern that says, sitting on a computer equals anxiety. My brain for a long time had created a pattern that says stress equals drinking, right? We create these associations and our brain responds like loud noises equals death. So my brain said, let's be more alert. But by removing the label disorder, that's how it started to change everything. We have to disassociate ourselves from the identity that this is who we are. And it's not easy, far from easy, right? Because we do that all the time. Like I've worked with people with mental health issues, with depression. They'll say things like, I am depressed. Mm-hmm. I have depression. And what happens is that becomes their self-identity. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying things like, my brain goes through a state of depression from time to time, but I am not my brain. My brain is not who I am. So the key thing here is to recognize and remember, and we can also get into specific actions on how to do this, but to kind of remember the mindset that there are no bad or good emotions. Mm. There are only emotions, and it's up to us to decide what we do with them. So really honing, like staying focused on that path that no emotion is bad. So let go of the judgment. And then once you let go of the judgment of it, recognizing that you are not your thoughts, you are not your emotions, you are not your experiences. Mm-hmm. You are the thinker of your thoughts, the feeler of your feelings, and the experiencer of your experiences. Mm-hmm. There is a space between what is and who you choose to be outside of what is. So I have a little mantra that always guides me when I'm in the space of pain today, like running ultra marathons or whatever. I'll say, and even my own emotions, I obviously still navigate challenging emotions from time to time, mm. but I'll say, be with what is, but do not become what is.
Mm. Mm, dude, that's amazing. And, you know, first and foremost, I love what you said about what fear really is. And the way that I think about it is, you know, it's a series of feedback loops that have evolved in humans for thousands of years. And exactly. Then, you know, like you said, in today's modern world, you know, we don't have tigers. You know, a lot of us necessarily don't live in that physically dangerous environments.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that fear has, you know, almost got to go somewhere, right? Like, you know, you yourself said, like, you know, a reason why you're doing, you know, a lot of ultra marathons and whatnot, it's to simulate that stress. It's
absolutely.
To simulate that adversity, you know, rather than, you know, go and find legitimate, you know, people shooting at you danger.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, the second thing that you said about kind of like labeling yourself and then living within that label, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's so important. So, you know, I remember I talked to you about this when we chatted earlier, and yeah. I kind of told you that, you know, I think that for some people, especially maybe like earlier people in their lives, I think it can be a little bit, you know, liberating to a sense of like when you realize that it's your brain that has anxiety or gets into moments or events of anxiety, rather than just thinking that, you know, there's something like inherently wrong with you because you know, you've been living in anxiety so much that you're not conscious of it. And, you know, I remember for me when I kind of fell down my dark path and, you know, people told me to go to the doctor and eventually I did. And literally in like a 10 minute visit, I talked about myself for like 5 minutes and, you know, I was already prescribed a, I forget the name of the medicine, but it was some sort of anti-anxiety medication because I faced really severe social anxiety. And I remember kind of looking at it and I remember just doing my own research and I remember kind of looking into it and I remember seeing all these different kinds of potential side effects that some people can have with these drugs. And the more I got down into it, the more I was like, wait, like, you know, I personally think that some of these drugs can definitely be of help depending on the person, how severe the case is. But I mean, there's a lot of things that you can do beforehand that are definitely less harmful, that are that definitely have less side effects. And so, you know, I'm curious for you, like, I'm curious, like, in terms of, you know, sort of moving past like that conceptual understanding of fear and kind of like reframing about it. Were there any like actions? Was there any, you know, sort of series of steps that you began to take to flip fear on its head?
Yeah. So absolutely. So fundamentally is stopping the demonization of it. And I cannot stress that enough. I know that's just a mindset piece, but it's really important. Like I worked with this one guy who said, I'm just waiting for the fear to go away so I quit my job and start my business. And I said, that's your problem. You're waiting for the fear to go. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. You're waiting for the fear to go away because he judged himself as weak for having the fear because we're told to be fearless. Don't be scared. All that kind of stuff, right? So letting go of that judgment, letting go of the fact that there are no bad or good emotions is really, really important. And then acknowledging that we don't control what first shows up, right? So neuroscience and spirituality have both shown this. And there's a really important spiritual concept that I think has been a game changer for me and those I've shared it with. And then I'll kind of break it down into a five-step sort of actionable plan to reframe your emotions and to use them in service of something positive. So Buddha said, we're all stabbed by the two darts of suffering. The first dart is the one we don't control. So the analogy I always like to give is when I stub my toe against a door, the first dart is the pain in my toe. The second dart is when I say things like, this door is stupid, I'm stupid, bad things only happen to me, this house sucks, God hates me, all this kind of stuff, right? That inner dialogue that we go into. And we do this in relation to our emotions as well. The first dart is the emotion we do not control. It's a pattern beyond our control now. Like I worked with a veteran who had severe anger issues and he went to a therapist who said, anger is just a choice. Stop feeling angry. And then he started beating himself up because he thought anger is just a choice. So he came to me and I said, look, right now you don't control the anger. Your brain has learned to associate that anger with any stressor, any stimuli. Little things like his lawnmower wouldn't work and he would get angry. DVD player would break down. He'd get angry. You know, so first we said, look, let's not try to fight the anger. Acknowledge its presence. The first dart was the anger. The second dart was the real problem. He started saying, what's wrong with me? Why does this happen to me? I'm messed up in the head. All that inner dialogue. We all know that our negative conversations that we go into our head, right? So pausing, noticing that, and I call this second dart syndrome. Letting go of those second dart spirals and acknowledging this thing is just there instead of then judging ourselves from it. Like I work with somebody who had fear around climbing and then she would say, what's wrong with me? Why am I scared? If I'm scared about this simple thing, I'll never write my book. I'll never do this. And you know, lack of self-worth, lack of self-love, that all that inner sort of second dart. So letting go of the second dart syndrome. And a simple way to do that is this five steps called LMNOP. So first step, L, label and language. Label the emotion. Just pause and label it. Neuroscience has shown that when you label an emotion, it releases activity from the emotional part of your brain and increases activity of the part of your brain related to focus and awareness. So essentially, you're disassociating yourself from that emotion. You're not becoming attached to it, which is a lot of what we talked about. Don't become that. Don't let that become your self-identity. So you label it. I'm feeling anxious. I'm feeling scared, whatever it may be. Then language. Shift your body language. Just shift into something more powerful. Stand tall. There has been research that's kind of disproved the sort of power poses, standing tall. But to me, it just makes sense to stand tall. You're going to feel a little better than if you're slouching and you know, in this sort of depressed, closed position. So stand tall. Feel confident. Label and language. M is meaning. What is the meaning you have created to the event leading to the emotion and the meaning you have created to the emotion? So with this guy I was working with who had anxiety around writing, he created a meaning that nobody'd want to read his writing. And he had also created a meaning about his anxiety, that he was weak, he was pathetic, he was a nobody for feeling the anxiety. He judged himself for the anxiety, right? So right now, you're just understanding what is the meanings you've created to the event and the emotion. Then the next step, this is kind of the key here, is the N. It's not me. It's not me, it's my brain. So you're disassociating yourself from that self-identity. You're just pausing and acknowledging whatever I'm going through right now, it's not me. I don't have to define myself by that. Then O, you opt for a new meaning. So as another example, when I was reaching out to the Dalai Lama to get the forward, which you touched on, the whole time, like it took me about 5-6 months of connecting with this monk there. Every time he wouldn't reply, like I wouldn't get an email back, I thought they hated me. Yeah. They hate my book. Who am I? All that good stuff, right? The self-doubt, which we all experience. I'm sure you have too.
100%.
Exactly, right? But the thing is, I can say I have those thoughts, but I don't have to be defined by those thoughts. And why am I feeling it? So O is opting for a new meaning. I had these thoughts because I thought they hate me. But then I also, the fear, the only reason I felt fear and anxiety, and I was terrified about writing a book on fear, ironically, but the only reason I was scared was because I cared about my message. The reason this guy was anxious about writing, this guy I worked with, was because he cared about his message. He wanted to help people with it. If I wasn't scared, I would have just put some garbage book out there, right? Like I was scared, so it made me write a better book. So I'm reframing my fear, my anxiety, and saying, oh, it's actually a sign of my love. Same thing with the guilt, which we talked about earlier, right? So opt for a new meaning. And then P, purpose and preemptive strikes. So P's purpose is where you're doing something. And however small, you're doing something to do a different action than what you're used to. Like with this guy I worked with, what he usually did, his pattern was sit at the computer to write, get severe anxiety. I mean, talking like sweaty palms, accelerated heart rate, severe anxiety, then run away and go watch TV to shut that all off, right? Mm. So now we need to rewire the brain, building new habits. You're literally, when I say rewire the brain, you're physically building a new brain, is doing something differently. So with him, we would just say, just write for 2 minutes. Even if you're just staring at the computer, nothing's coming out, just type for 2 minutes. Then we can go to 5, then 10, so on and so forth. But just something differently in line with that purpose. And the second part of the P is preemptive strikes, where you preemptively prepare for obstacles you know will show up. Write down in detail. I know that every time I sit on the computer, I'm going to feel anxiety. So I'm going to sit down at the computer at 5 p.m. I will feel anxious. I will use the LMNOP tool. I will write for 2 minutes. You know, you're writing down in detail how you will navigate this obstacle. And research has shown that these elderly patients who were recovering from knee and hip replacement surgery, when they would write down in detail that, okay, I'm 5 p.m., I'm going to take a bath. I know it's going to hurt my knee, so I'm going to do this. And they would break down in detail how they would do it, what time they would do it. They recovered 3 times faster than those who did not do it. So you're preemptively preparing for the obstacle you know will show up. And just a mindset piece to guide you on this thing, because as we do this, right, as we go through our changing our patterns, changing our behavior, you'll often say, you'll hear people say things like, I suck at this, I'm bad at this, I'm weak at this. And a key mindset that's been a game changer for me and a lot of people I've worked with is don't think if there is no bad or good or strong or weak. There's only trained or untrained. So always ask yourself, If you feel like today I'm not the best at squats, instead of saying I'm weak at this or I suck at this, I'll just say I'm untrained at this. Now, this doesn't mean that objectively I could be weaker compared to other people, right, but just in terms of how I approach it in my own mind, I'll just say I'm untrained. Because when I'm untrained, then I can do something about it. I can train. I can work. It cultivates that growth mindset.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And I think it's a very, like to sort of say that you suck at this or you're bad at this versus kind of saying you either put in the hours and you trained and other better people have put in more hours than you.
Exactly.
And, you know, looking at the first one, you know, that's a pretty naive, kind of like childish way of looking at the way the world works, because, you know, at the end of the day, that could just become an excuse that, you know, you just sort of build in. And so, dude, that was a great framework, but you know, I'm wondering, like, so in terms of this, in terms of actually sort of changing this, so an example, so let's say someone gets into a car accident, okay, and they, you know, it, you know, not, you know, a little serious, but not too serious, you know, nobody died, but also, you know, a couple people got hurt, some cars got totaled, and then now, and I hear this all the time, that's why I'm using this example, like people email me this all the time and I just don't necessarily know how to help them. And then now they, like whenever they drive, they have like this tendency of like something bad is about to happen again. Like they feel their heart beat up, their mind starts racing, almost as if like they feel like that traumatic event is happening again. So I know you just kind of went through that framework generally, but like what would you tell that person? What would you maybe walk them through, if that makes sense?
Yeah. First off, I would normalize that thought, normalize that feeling, because in my experience, whenever somebody has that, what they do is then judge themselves for having that. How do I get rid of this? What's wrong with me? All those sort of second darts, right? So first off, we'd say it's understandable. It's normal. You went through this incident. Your brain, so getting self-awareness around it, your brain registers emotionally intense and fear-based memories much more deeper into your subconscious than happy memories. Just evolutionary speaking, if you think about it, when we miss a sunset, no big deal. We'll wake up the next day. But if I miss the big saber-tooth tiger around the corner, I'm dead, right? So our brain is going to be more wired to be staying present to dangers. So first thing is just to normalize it. It's okay. You're nothing wrong with you. Then, and I struggled with this as an example, like even when I went to, I used to go to New York City a lot, and I struggled with it because I hated the crowds. I was always hypervigilant, right? Every crowd is potential threat. So once you normalize it, accept that there's nothing wrong with you, then you start doing something about it. So then it's like literally pausing and noticing the emotion. Don't getting caught up in it. So practice, like maybe one thing I would do in this scenario is just go sit in the car. Just go, don't go driving anywhere. Just go sit in the car. And label what's happening. Go through in your own mind and literally talking out loud to yourself. Like if you see me walking around my house, I look like a crazy person because I'm talking out loud to myself all the time. So talk out loud to yourself. Okay, I'm feeling anxiety. Let's look at why. And so as you're running through this process in your head, going in deep and understanding. And you're understanding that, look, this anxiety I'm feeling, it's nothing wrong with me. It's because I care about my life and this thing happened to me. So I'm just, you know, I just want to understand this anxiety, but it's a sign of my love. So reframing any emotion to an expression of love. I often hear, you know, fear and love are enemies. You'll often hear there's two ways to being, fear and love. Right. Highly flawed concept, highly flawed concept. Fear is not the enemy of love. Fear is an expression of love. Reframe it. Fear is an expression of love.
Say that again.
Sure. Fear is not the enemy of love. Fear is an expression of love. Really important. I worked with somebody who was terrified of public speaking, one of the most biggest fears. And when he suddenly reframed it to love, he realized because he loves his message. He loved the people he wanted to serve. You love your life. That's why you're feeling anxious. You love the people who might have been in the car with you when this happened, right? So allowing yourself to acknowledge it as an experience of love. And then you start building that stress inoculation, essentially. You build a tolerance to be in the car. Maybe the next step is you drive from here to your neighbor's house. Mm-hmm. Maybe the next step is you then drive further. But once you build yourself to acknowledge, and I'm not saying it'll instantly go away, but like even with going to New York, for example, I would struggle, but I would go there. Practice it, be with it, notice it. And one of the shifts I would also make is start looking for things to acknowledge and celebrate in the environment. So I'm rewiring my brain. Instead of only looking for threats, I'm consciously saying, man, it's beautiful how a person built a city like this. I mean, the human ability to build massive cities is incredible. So I'm shifting my mindset to, instead of focusing on threats, to look at all the awesomeness, the amazingness. And you have to consciously do this until it becomes subconscious. Any pattern when you change, it requires the activation of consciousness to then until it becomes subconscious. So I call it like sort of an action awareness cycle. You go through the process of awareness, take action, and you have to take action. And it's going to be hard. This is a key point too, is when you do this, it will be hard. There's no way to get around this. Like I worked, there was somebody, I did an interview actually recently with Dr. Drew. And at the end of the interview, somebody asked a question that they had gone through the bombing in Boston. And they were struggling with sort of post-traumatic stress symptoms as a result. And so we were having it was a very brief conversation. It was just on air. So it wasn't very brief. But at one point, I was sharing sort of some strategies to go. You have to go into those spaces, try to understand the post-traumatic stress, go into those events, like stress inoculation. And then she responded and she said something like, but it's really hard. And I said that to me was the insight, the key there. And I said, I know it's hard, but if you go through the hard part, eventually it will become easier. Otherwise, you can live your whole life dealing with this, staying in your subconscious, but you have to go into those spaces. And a really beautiful quote that summarizes from Carl Jung, he says, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. Until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life. And another quote from him that sort of it's really synergizes with this one is, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. And when you think about those two things, that's the ticket. That's the key right there. Go into those painful spaces. Confront that. It will be hard. There's nothing I or anybody else can say that will make it easy. But on the other side of that, it will be far, far, far easier than not confronting it. I always like to say, if you don't seek out a worthy struggle, struggle will find you anyway. So you got to...
That's so true.
You got to go into those spaces.
That's so true, man. I really love that. And yeah, I mean, my general idea of that is like, you know, if the mind has no problems, it will create, its own problems.
Love that. Absolutely.
You and I know that. And that's why, you know, we try our best to, you know, put ourselves through struggles. And I know you recently came back from this expedition from Norway. Trotting through the Arctic. I mean, that's crazy, man. I mean, tell me a little bit about that. What was that like?
Sure. I spent about 5-6 days in the Norwegian wilderness north of the Arctic Circle. It was about minus 38 one day, doing a polar expedition. So dragging a sled with all our food, fuel, and supplies out there. This was relatively chill compared to like 1 month in Greenland, but it was a refresher for me about the polar expedition lifestyle because I have some much bigger trips planned in the near future. Later this year, I'm going to be skiing 3 weeks across the Patagonian ice cap. I want to go to the North Pole, South Pole, climb bigger mountains. So for me, that's like my worthy struggle, is engaging suffering in the wilderness. As you know, we touched on earlier, I'm an ultra marathon runner. So recently I ran 80 miles around a 0.2 mile loop. So 400 laps around this 0.2 mile loop for like 20 hours plus. Brutal physical and psychological torture. So I do these things to engage my worthy struggle. And sort of the key lesson here is that everybody's got their own worthy struggle. You don't have to do what I do, you know, or what you do. Find your own worthy struggle. Find your path. I have another friend who's about to be a grandmaster in chess. That's her worthy struggle, you know, like it's hard. It is hard, but that's her worthy struggle. So I do these intense things in the outdoors, in nature to challenge myself, to test myself, because, and this ties into a lot of everything else we were saying, is that, you know, when you confront your demons, when you go into those dark spaces, the key thing there is also then channeling them into something. And the biggest thing I've seen, especially with like people who have lost to addiction and people who struggle with that, is when you come out of that, that void needs to be filled with something. We need, I mean, Man's Search for Meaning. You read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning?
Of course, 100%.
Absolutely, right? Yeah, one of the most powerful books is that we need meaning in our lives. So we got to find, so channeling that stuff into your own worthy struggle. And again, this is mine, outdoor expeditions, but whatever your pain is, you can channel. Like when I shared earlier about putting my friend's picture saying, "This should have been you, earned this life." My guilt, I didn't just have that up there. My guilt was channeled to then writing my, like that poster helped me finish writing my book, Fearvana. But I had a worthy struggle, which at that point was writing the book, to channel my demons into, you know? So you're always looking, how can I channel this into some purposeful struggle?
Yeah, that's so awesome, man. And I love what you said about, you know, you don't have to, you know, go out and go to Norway or go to Greenland and kind of do this in the Arctic. You know, for me, I mean, writing my book was terrible.
I'm sure, man.
For sure, it was meaningful. 100%, it was super meaningful, and that's why I did it.
Yeah.
But, you know, writing a book. You know, I've never been an athlete ever in my life, but in June, I'm running half a triathlon, and so
awesome,
I think,
man,
life is all about, like you said, like just finding these struggles, because I know if you don't choose it, life will find some way to put that in. And I don't really want to, you know, I would rather choose my problems.
Exactly.
And so I'm, you know, I'm curious because, you know, I'm sure you get this a lot, right? And I'm sure a lot of people that are maybe even like, you know, similar to your field in terms of people like, you know, David Goggins running like 100 miles, and people now think they have to run like these massive races. I'm curious, like, for someone who has maybe never like tried to create their own struggle purposefully, are there any like guidelines, anything that you would maybe suggest for people to just sort of start out and to try to find that path for them?
Find ways to test yourself. It's as simple as that. There's not like some complicated answer. I mean, a big part of it is the mindset piece, which we've touched on, and a key thing to think about, which we also kind of touched on, but really to elaborate on, is that there will always be problems, whether you like it or not. Somebody recently asked me, you know, they gave me a very specific scenario, like somebody's going through a divorce, how would you help that person? And I said, fundamentally, at the highest level, at the meta level, it doesn't matter what the problem is, whether they're going through a divorce, whether they've lost somebody, whatever the challenge is, the fundamental problem is we're always looking for the easiest path outside to get out of that. That's the problem, is we're looking for the easiest path because we think when we get there, wherever there is, whether it be $1 million, the house, the car, you write your book and now it's published, whatever we think that there is, we think our problems will end, and they won't. They will not end. It doesn't, when we see this, people who, celebrities who seemingly have everything, they have their own problems. So a key thing to remember is that progress is not the elimination of problems. Progress is the creation of new problems. So you will always have problems. So fundamentally falling in love with the process of engaging the problem, because through every problem on the other side is a new awakening. So falling in love with that process of engaging a challenge, because on the other side of it, you will find a new you. Right? We are all versions, which is why I love Humans 2.0. The title is that, thinking of yourself in versions. You know, right now I might be Akshay 70.0, and then I'll go through some new struggle, and then I'll find Akshay 71, right? Like, there's think of yourself, every problem, every challenge, every barrier is an access point to the next version of yourself. So you have to seek out that, because again, it's going to be there anyway. So go into spaces, find ways to test yourself, find ways to find problems. If you don't have a problem in your life, that's a problem. So look for a problem, seek it out. It could be, and you know, we all have different levels. You don't have to do what I do or Goggins does. Yeah. Look for where you're at. And to be also with me, at one point in my life, man, I was terrified of Ferris wheels. Not even like a roller coaster, a freaking Ferris wheel. So I didn't get here overnight. You find your line. I call it the zone of Nirvana. The line between the level of fear and the level of training required to address that fear. So if it's too much, and we don't want to go too hard. Like, I can't, you know, go solo climbing up Everest tomorrow. I will either die or I just won't be able to handle it. It's too much, right? So find your line. It could be walking up to somebody in a bar, you know, a member of the opposite sex or a man, a woman, whoever, walking up to somebody. That's scary. That's hard. Or it could be running a 5K. It could be running 1 mile. It doesn't matter what it is. Mm. Find something that pushes you just enough to test you. And the only way you can do that is by getting out there and doing it. And then you will see, is this thing too much? Is it too little? Like, it might be, if it's too little, then you got to push a little harder. And the harder, the more you keep pushing, the more you will engage your fear, the more you will test yourself, and the more you will actually tap into your courage. Because here's like the key thing, you courage cannot exist without fear, and strength cannot exist without struggle. So you got to go into those spaces, and it will be hard. But just remember that happiness, and sort of at a meta level, happiness is not the elimination of sadness. Happiness is the ability to find the gift in sadness. So find the gift in your pain. Find the gift in the sadness. Find the gift in the problems. And you'll go into those spaces that will be challenging to confront. But the more you go there, the more you will learn. And the more you will then evolve to that next version of yourself.
Mm. And I think, you know, happiness is synonymous with progress. And to go back to what you said, is progress is the creation of problems. And that's what happiness is.
Of new problems, exactly.
Of new problems. That's the quote I want to keep, man. That's really beautiful. I mean, man, Akshay, you've really blessed us here with this time. And, you know, I always like to close off the podcast by, you know, asking the guest if they can leave like an actionable exercise, or maybe even a question that somebody can ask themselves, aside from, you know, step one, go to Amazon and pick up a copy of Nirvana. Put the link in the podcast description below. Great book. But yeah, I'd love if you could leave us with an actionable exercise.
Sure. I'll leave a question and then a sort of actionable exercise, because our brain's always asking questions, and the questions we ask ourselves shape our destiny, right? So there's this on the highest level, the existential level, is we ask the sort of question that, who am I? And I think that's a mistake to ask that, because I believe, and I've learned through life experience, through research, there's no self to find. There's only a self to create. So instead of asking, who am I, ask yourself constantly every day, who do I want to become? Who do I want to evolve into? And when you ask that, you're focused on the forward. You're focused on the step ahead. So you might have gone through stuff in your past. God knows I get it if you have, but it shapes you, it affects you, but it doesn't define you. So who do I want to become is a question that you keep asking yourself, to reframe your demons, to engage those demons, to then step into your fear, step into struggle. And to then translate that into an action is, if I sort of summarize the ethos of Nirvana in two words, it would be to suffer well. Suffer well. So the action is kind of something I touched on, and it's simple, but I believe there's no more profound action that will help you evolve is to suffer well, to seek out suffering, to seek out exercises that will force you to go into a space where one part of you wants to quit and the other wants to fight. If you engage that inner battle within yourself, you will find the warrior within. You got to go into those spaces to find the warrior. And that will only happen when you confront pain, confront darkness, confront your demons, however you want to call it. I always like another tagline that I like to say is, the greater your demons, the greater the divinity required to defeat them. So engage those demons. and you'll find the divinity.
Damn, dude, this has been a like personal top five favorite episode.
Honored, brother. Thank you.
Seriously, man, I appreciate everything that you do, everything that you have done, and everything that you will continue to do, man. Again, highly, highly recommend people to check out Fearvana if they want to actually develop a, you know, a good, productive relationship with fear, and not just, you know, try to be fearless, which in turn, you know, reinforces it and makes it more powerful among us. Everything that we've talked about, dude, you are the best. I want to thank everyone out there for listening. This has been your host, Mark Metry.
Hey, you made it to the end of the podcast. It's your host, Mark Metry, and I just want to take a moment here and sincerely acknowledging you for taking the time out of your own day, your own life, to invest it into listening to this podcast, to gain something valuable and implement into your life to make it better. This is what it's all about. Now, if you actually gain value from this episode and you want to give me value somehow, I would unbelievably appreciate it if you went to Apple Podcasts, iTunes, if you have an Apple product where you listen to podcasts, and please leave this show a review. You are free to send me a message, email, contact information is in the description below. Thank you so much for listening. Let's get this grassroots movement going.